So we're going to start a new series, Meretz Hashem, today. What I'd like to do is begin learning certain topics instead of just covering from the parasha three or four verses each week and then going through the whole Chumash, getting three verses here and three verses here and three verses there. We're going to take a couple of topics and learn them in depth. Something that I've always wanted to do myself personally, and I'm going to use you. Since you're sitting here anyway, so we'll do it together. We're all going to study and go through this this process. I originally advertised that we were going to start with the Akedah, with the binding of Isaac, but as we went through the Parsha yesterday, we did last week this Parshas Noach, I realized that there were too many stories before the binding of Isaac that we needed to cover. We needed to cover this, the Noach and his vineyard. We need to cover the Tower of Babel. There are a couple of other topics which precede the binding of Isaac. And so I felt, even though I wasn't going to let you know until you got here, we were going to go back and cover some of those earlier topics, and we'll eventually get to the binding of Isaac. So for those of you who are only here to study about the binding of Isaac,
we can leave.
What can I say? Now, the beginnings of this, some of you may or may not have attended. I gave a class on the Garden of Eden already, and on Cain and Hevel, on Cain and Abel, on those first two episodes. Which this may or may not eventually tie in, but this I'm not starting totally in the middle. We have done some of those earlier topics. The flood was a little bit too big for me right now to handle. But maybe we'll get back to the flood as well. But in any case, for this particular episode, Noach and his vineyard. So I'll give you the background, and then we'll study the actual story. The story itself in the Chumash is all of 12 verses. Not very long, and as many of the stories of the Chumash, and this is really why I have so desired to do this, is because major episodes in world Jewish history are condensed into very few verses. And they're significant episodes in our history and have ramifications and reverberations throughout our history. And the Torah is very careful in the words it chooses and how it tells us and what it tells us, and they really need to be studied. So this is one of those events. Where are we as far as the timeline? So the timeline is, we have the big flood. We know we're skipping throughout the 120 years in which Noach builds his ark, and then the year's time that they are on the ark. The Torah then records afterwards, they finally make land, the waters recede. Noach, the first thing that he does after getting out is he offers up sacrifices for having survived. Then we have a brief episode of the rainbow, which we actually could do as well as a possible topic, but we have the episode of the rainbow, and God promises never to destroy the world again, makes a covenant with Noah and his sons, and then this is the first episode that we have following that. Wow, I made 10 copies, I can't believe we're 11 people.
Let me, 120 years to build?
Yeah. Yeah, I can run up.
Time was measured differently. What
do you mean?
It wasn't 24 hours to the day.
Sure, why not? Yeah. Time to Noah. We're not talking about the 6 days of creation. I mean, from for sure, it's the same. Okay, so what I'd like you to do, you know what, I'm actually going to go upstairs. What I'd like you to do is take 2 minutes, read through the story yourself, just in English, you could just read through it. Before we begin, what we're going to do today is we're going to go through the story, and we're just going to raise a lot of questions. We're just going to go through in depth the questions and understand. But before we do that, just read it through, just to be a little bit familiar, and I'll actually take the minute. While you do that, I'll make another copy. I have
make
it off my computer.
I'll make a couple. Make a couple. Sam's supposed to come.
Okay, so just read through it, literally 1 minute, and then we'll go over it.
He'll be short again. He gets really short, by the way. Shame.
Thank you. Okay. Anyone else? Who needed? Anyone else?
Yeah, we got.
One more.
No.
Sam gets here.
Okay. Ready? Let's go. Everyone had a chance to read through it? Okay. I'm going to borrow a concept from Rabbi David Foreman, who I based the earlier two lectures on, the Garden of Eden and Cain and Abel story. He makes the following distinction, which I'm going to borrow this distinction from him as we go along. He has what he calls big questions and little questions, meaning to say as follows. All the questions that we're going to pose and that we'll raise as we read through this together now are important and need to be answered, and I hope we will be able to answer all of them. I even have my notebook and my pen to cover if you guys ask questions that I'm not prepared for. I'll take note of them to make sure that we fit them in. But there are different types of questions. There are questions on the text. Why did it use this word as opposed to this word? Why did it say this? And it's an important question that needs to be addressed. What is the text telling us? What does the Torah want from us that it said it like this? But those are like little questions in his words. Not little in the sense of they're not important. They're textual questions. And then we have the big questions, the elephant in the room questions, the kind of questions that if somebody were sitting next to you on an airplane and said, "Oh, I see you're Jewish. I always had a question on the following story." And they asked you the question, like, if you can't answer this question, then you don't understand what's going on. If you can't explain why it's this way, for example, in the case of this Garden of Eden, like, what did the snake want when it was tempting Eve to eat of the fruit? Good question. Never thought of that. But that's an interesting question. Like, why did the snake engage the whole discussion anyway? What did he want from Eve? Never thought of that. Well, if you haven't thought of that question and you can't answer that question, then you can't possibly understand the story, because that's a fundamental question on the story, not necessarily a textually based question like why this and not that, which are also important, but it's a larger scaling back existential type question on the story. What in the world is going on here? I want to ask all the questions, but let's just identify as we go along, you know, the types of questions. There are going to be one or two elephant in the room type questions, like what is this about? And then we'll have lots of little questions. Usually, the little questions give rise to the answer to the big questions. The Torah is giving us lots of hints along the way that if you ask the right big question, you'll find the answers are there within the text. So let's ask them all. I hope you had a chance to read it through quickly just to familiarize yourself with the story, and let's go through. Again, the agenda for today is really not so much answers. Let's just familiarize ourselves with the question, with the story. This is a story which, again, we read it every year, but we just like fly through it. So in 12 verses, it's done before you even found the right page, but there, as always, is a lot here, and let's go through it. Okay, ready? Let's do it. 18 Yudches Viu Bnei Noach Hayotzim Min Hateva Shem V'Chom V'Yofes. The sons of Noach who came out from the ark were Shem, Chom, and Yofes. V'Chom Hu Avi Chenaan, and Chom the second of the three sons listed here is the father of Chenaan. Okay, some questions. I see right around.
Why is he the father?
Say that again. Ask your question.
Why is Shem chosen as the father of Canaan?
Okay, what do you mean? Why is he chosen? Canaan was a person.
Why distinguish him? I mean, there's three sons.
Excellent. Okay, so now the basic question is: we have three sons, and one of the sons, Ham, is for some reason at this point of our story told that he is the father of this child named Canaan, which is a name which is of course familiar to us because that's the name eventually we have the land of Canaan, which the Jews will inherit. But right now we're just talking about the person Canaan, which is going to be an obvious textual type question, like why are we told here that Ham is the father of Canaan? Excellent. What else? Jennifer, you were starting to say something?
No, the same thing as Lucy.
Same thing. So let me say something. Yes.
The sons who came out of the ark. Mm-hmm. It almost implies that not everybody came out of the ark.
Okay, excellent. I don't know if that's true. It's a good question. In other words, I was going to ask that question almost a little bit differently. If you actually do have your chumashim in front of you, so you can open this up. We're starting in the middle of a story. I know this is a little episode, but this is not the beginning of the entire story. So let me read to you, or you can read it inside if you flip open your book, starting from page 30. read to you three other verses, and then I imagine you'll share the same question that I have on this verse. Start right from the very beginning on page 30, which is the beginning of Parshas Noach. And I'm going to read to you three verses. The first one that I'm going to read to you is here in chapter 6, verse 10, which is the second verse of our story. I'll just start from the top. These are the offspring of Noach. Noach was a righteous man, perfect in his generations. Noach walked with God. So we have a pause in who the offspring were, in which we describe Noach a little bit. And now we tell you who his offspring are. Noach had begotten three sons, Shem, Cham, and Japheth.
Well, what are they like?
Okay, so the Torah does not tell us what they were like. In other words, the Torah tells us that Noach was a righteous individual, walked with God, perfect in his generation, so he was saved. And he had three children. So we are not told, an excellent point, we are not told whether or not the children of Noach actually had any merit on their own to be saved, or they simply were children of Noach, and we are not told about them. But what we are told is that they were three. They were Shem, they were Cham, and they were Japheth, those three sons. Yeah.
Well, since we were told that at the beginning, then the question on our sheet would be, why do we have to
Excellent.
Know the names?
Now, I'm going to corroborate that question by reading to you two other verses. So what I want to point out is that verse number one, right in the beginning of our parsha, tells us that Noah had three children, Shem, Cham, and Japheth. Flip one page to page 32, or excuse me, two pages, in the middle of chapter 7, verse 13. It's on page 35, 713. On that very day, this is the day that the rains began. On that very day, Noach came with Shem, Cham, and Japheth, Noach's sons, with Noach's wife and the three wives of his sons, into the ark. So we are told he had three sons, and when it begins to rain, the Torah then tells us again that Noach and his three sons, Shem, Cham, and Japheth, all enter into the ark. Well, guess what we're going to find if you'll flip one or two more pages. Chapter 8, 15, verse 15 on page
38-39. He had several wives.
After the whole episode of the flood, after the whole year, and now it's time to leave. And verse 15 on page 39, God spoke to Noach saying, "Go forth from the ark, you and your wife, your sons and your sons' wives with you. I have now told to leave." And we actually then find in verse 18, so Noach went forth, and his sons, his wife, and his sons' wives with him. So I have four verses, two of which define, the first one tells me his three sons, Shem, Cham, and Japheth. Then I'm told they all went into the ark. Then I'm told a command, God says, all of you, you, Noach, and your three sons, leave the ark. Then the Torah says, they did. Noach and his three sons left the ark. And now we have our verse introducing this next episode that says again, the sons of Noach who went out from the ark were Shem, Cham, and Japheth. How many times do we need to know that Noach had three sons, Shem, Cham, and Japheth, and that they left the ark? This is the fifth verse that is now describing or telling us who they were and that they went in and now have exited.
Okay, well, it talks about the sons' wives.
Okay.
Did they have wives that came in with them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They all went in.
Yeah, they all went in with them. Right. They all went in with them, and then they all were commanded to go out with them. Yeah.
In the Torah, when you mention somebody's name, it usually means that they have merit. So there's two ways to look at this. Either they had merit on their own,
mm-hmm.
or they're protected because Noach is protected, and this is kind of a deal that God promised Noach, that your specific family and these people that we're mentioning now are going to be protected. Whatever happens, they're coming in the ark with you, they're going out. So I don't know whether it's on Noach's merit or they have any individual merit of their own.
Okay,
the
unclear,
sons
I agree,
have children,
unclear.
And did the sons have children?
We are not told anything about entering and exiting the ark, about any of them having children.
We're just told that they are the seeds for the future world.
Correct.
So, in a sense, their three characteristics are the characteristics of humanity. And maybe that is the reason that's all there is.
Excellent. Okay, but we are told one over. Excellent. Okay, very possible. Yeah.
So that's somewhere where I was going. If we were to possibly change the word sons to builders, if that would give us a
The B'nai Noach. Okay. You're correct that the word ben is very much related to the Hebrew word boneh, to build. Sons are builders. In other words, they build on what was left to them from their parents. There's a lot of, in Hebrew language and root words, there's a strong connection between the word ben and a boneh. But, okay, maybe on a deeper level. But on a simple level, let's just, this. What I'd like to do is go through the text, then go through the commentators, and then go through the sages in the Chazal and the Midrashim, like sort of build on these things. But as far as the text, we'll just simply deal with them as being the sons. So what we have here in this first verse, bottom line, there are three times the three sons are listed. Is there any difference in the way that they're listed in terms of their names, or is it always Shem, Cham, and Yefes in the three verses that we read?
Always
the same. That's correct. It's always Shem, Cham, and Yefes. What would that at least suggest to us as far as their ages?
The oldest.
And it would certainly suggest. And it's possible not that way, but when the Torah does it where it does not want to list them as far as their age, then when it lists their names, it switches their orders at some point. Meaning, the five daughters of Tzlafchad, for example, who did not have an inheritance in the desert after their father died, so when they're listed, the two different times that they're listed in different orders. And from there, the sages pointed out, because their age would go like this, but in terms of greatness, it would go like this. But if here we have all three times, they're listed the same, all three times, it would seem to me that it was Shem the oldest, then Cham, and then Yafes. Okay, let us move on with the major question in this verse would then be why is that we told this, and of course the back half of that verse, why are we told here that Cham, who is the middle son, is the father of Canaan, and that's somehow important to us as we begin this story. Obviously it will be important to us as we begin this story, and the Torah right away in the beginning of the story tells us Cham is the father of the character called Canaan. Yud Tes 19. Shlosha Eila b'nei Noach, these three were the sons of Noach. And from these, Me'ele Naftza Chol Ha'aretz, the whole world was spread out. Again, a little bit repetitive, that from these were the three sons of Noach, and then the Torah adds what we just heard a moment ago from Paul, that this is it. These three sons, everything that would exist in the world will be able to trace themselves back to one of these three. And they talk today about modern genetics, saying there are, you know, five families, eight families, 10 families. We could sort of trace the genetic code back to a small number of families. World history can trace themselves back to three families, these three men. Noah will not have any more children. So it is these three, Shem, Cham, and Yafes, that the entire world population will descend from. So that we could trace, in terms of world history, it's Adam, first man, taking it down to Noach 10 generations later. Noach splits into three, and then those three, the whole world, will come from those three. Who are we descended from? Shem.
Shem.
We are from Shem. So the Jews, Avraham, comes from Shem, and therefore, so from this line of three, which the whole world will spread out from, we are descended from Shem, the eldest, will have Avraham, and then from Avraham, of course, Yitzhak, Yaakov, the 12 sons, and then our whole lineage will follow from there.
So who comes from the other sons?
Everybody else. But some came from Shem also. In other words, we're not the only descendants of Shem. In other words, for example, the Arabs are also from Shem because they're also from Avraham. So there, I don't know how it breaks down in terms of Near Eastern and Far Eastern and which parts of Europe. I don't know how that's going to work. You know, I couldn't tell you. But these three are the base of everything.
Am I late?
No, you're totally fine.
Thank you.
Totally fine. In fact, we'll go over everything that we said from the beginning again.
Sit down.
Okay.
You'll excuse me when I tell you.
I'd excuse you even if you don't tell me.
Thank you.
Okay, next. Chaf 20. Vayochel Noach ish ha'adama vayita karem. Now, this pasuk is very difficult to translate because there are two phrases here which do not translate well, and there's major disputes amongst the commentators how to translate them. So what I did is I tried to keep it as true to the main, as to the literal translation of the words, and that would leave the first word, Vayochel, let's leave that out for now. But Noach has an Ish Adama. An Ish Adama means literally a man of the earth. A man of the earth. And what did he do? Vayitakarem, he planted a vineyard. Now the word vayochel, the first word of this pasuk, is very difficult, and there are two ways of translating that, which I have both of them here on the sheet. I wasn't sure what to do, so I put them both there. Sometimes the word vayochel is a haschala, is a beginning. So the word would translate, and Noach began. Noach, the man of the earth, began and planted a vineyard. Now that rendering of the verse would mean, again, where are we in terms of context of the story? The boat has just landed, it's docked, he offered up a sacrifice, God gives him the rainbow, says, I will no longer destroy the world, and now Noach begins life anew. And what does he do as he begins life anew? Plants a vineyard. That would be the reading of the verse if we translate the word vayochel as, and he began. Now vayochel has another meaning, and it means chulin, or chol, or empty, or to debase, to degrade. And Rashi reads the word that way as vayochel Noach, and Noach debased or degraded himself and planted a vineyard. Now we're going to see that Rashi is based a little bit more on the translation of the sages of Chazal more than the simplest reading. The simplest reading would be, and he started. And Noach started his new world. Noach, the Ish Adamah, the man of the earth, started and planted a vineyard. But I want to mention to you that the sages saw in this negativity. They saw in this a language. The Torah does not just use a word to begin, that only means to begin. The word it uses to describe the beginning process, the first thing that he does of planting a vineyard, they use a word which also means he debased himself. Now, let's get some thoughts on this verse. What do we, what, there's a lot here, yeah.
I don't understand.
So, it was God that told him to build an ark and gave him all the instructions, and it doesn't say anything here that God told him to build a vineyard.
Okay, so it seems like, excellent, good point. Whose initiative is this to plant a vineyard? Seems clear that it's Noah. Good point, well taken, yeah.
I don't understand debased himself.
Meaning why?
Why?
Okay, so I'm saying, so that's what right now I'm doing more questions than answers. Yeah. So the sages saw in Noach planting a vineyard as the first thing, in other words, the simple meaning of the word, is that this is what he started with. In that, the sages saw negativity. Something was wrong, but in other words, but not only because, it seems, it's unclear if it's because of what will happen, or that inherent to the act of starting with a vineyard, something was wrong in that. There is something in which he was debasing himself by opening this new world by beginning with a vineyard.
Should have had a sacrifice,
well, could
or something.
Have had a memory from before the world was destroyed that actually provided that information to the sages? I mean, because of the misuse of the vineyard before in the previous world.
Could be. We don't have any official record that the destruction of the world prior was because of drunkenness and misuse of wine, though. That's not written anywhere. Not that I know. I don't know everything that's been written. So anyway, the text of the Chumash Elise does not give us any hints that that was the particular problem. But clearly Noach was aware of wine from before. Where did he get his vineyard from? What do you mean he planted a vineyard?
That's right.
They had seeds with them in the ark.
Right? They must have prepared for this. Noach has to have had, taken with him, whatever was going to be planted, whatever was going to be harvested and grown. You have to have had prepared for that. It wasn't going to be left after the flood. So of all the things that he had taken with him, he had taken with him a vineyard to plant, and that's what he starts with. He starts with his vineyard. Yeah.
Comment on what you just said, and then another question. You said he had to have brought seeds, but was it when the dove returned to the ark, it had a leaf?
An olive branch floating somewhere. So, okay, anything, because the sages, I'm coming from the sages point out what I just said, that they must have taken it with him, but you're right, there must have been some foliage that survived, because of course the olive, the famous olive branch in the mouth of the dove. That's a good point.
Right, another question on this verse is, what does it mean, the man of the earth?
Excellent, I was waiting for that one. That's an interesting way to define Noach. What was Noach's profession before the flood?
He
built an ark.
They built
the ark. Excellent. We have no idea. We have no idea. All we know is that the Torah defines that Noah found favor, found grace in the eyes of Hashem, and he was a tzaddik, he was a righteous individual, he was whole and perfect in his generation, and God asks him to build an ark, so he becomes a carpenter. But we don't know what he was. So it's interesting that now, as he exits the ark, and he has not yet chosen his profession, he hasn't done anything, but he's now defined as an Ish Adama, man of the earth. Very interesting way of defining Noach, the survivor of the ark, the survivor of the flood, the man through who him and his children will now repopulate the world, is called an Ish Adama, a man of the earth. Very interesting phrase. Now, if any of you were around for either the Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, or the Kain and Hevel classes, you'll recall that there was a tremendous focus on the role of the earth in both of those stories. When man is exiled, he's exiled from the Garden of Eden, and what's his punishment? The earth will no longer yield its produce without a fight. Now you're going to have to sweat. By the sweat of your brow, you'll eat bread because it's going to grow thorns and thistles. No longer will it easily produce for you. And then that's furthered in the story of Cain and Abel after the first murder. Cain gets it even worse. He's exiled from the earth. He's going to become a wanderer on the earth. The earth will now never produce its full bounty, even when you sweat. Whereas Adam only had to sweat to get the earth's bounty. Now Cain was punished in that the earth will not even produce its full bounty, even when you sweat. And there's always that emphasis on the relationship between Adam and the earth, and then Cain and the earth. And now we find that again, Noach, as he exits the ark, is defined as an Ish Ha'adama, a man of the earth, and he plants himself a vineyard. Alright, let's go on. 21, Chaf Aleph. Vayesh Minayah, yeah.
Should Noah have asked God for more help or support?
Good question. I don't know. And just following up, that we see that it's not recorded that he did. You know, my simple answer to you is yes, always. And the more you ask, right? If you have a relationship with God, the more you ask for help, the better your life will be. So it's interesting that the Torah does not record anything like that. But I don't know how much more to say about that. It's an interesting point. Chaval, let's move on. Vayesh min hayayin. Vayishkar, he drank of the wine and became drunk. Vayizgal besoich oholo, and he became uncovered within his tent. Now we know that a lot of time goes by. From the time that he planted this vineyard until the time that he actually got wine, it doesn't seem like this is going to be the next day. But I don't know what he's doing in the meanwhile, but the Torah goes right to the fact that he plants his vineyard, harvests his grapes, produces wine, and he gets drunk. And then in his state of drunkenness, he becomes uncovered in his tent. Okay, kind of straightforward. I mean, this is going to be one of those questions of like, this will be one of the elephant kind of questions. Like, what? He got drunk? Like on purpose? Like this, he plants his wine? Why? How? How could it be that Noah, after all of this, what was going on, that he ends up getting drunk here in his tent, drinking wine? Is there some significance? Is the Torah defining some type of change, you know, that he was able to, was the world a different place in terms of his ability to, that the wine that he had had before now had a different impact on him? He drunk himself into a stupor, he forgot, like what, he wasn't with buddies at a bar where he wasn't paying attention to how much he was drinking, and before he knew it, the game was going on for so long and he kept having one drink, no, he ended up being drunk. He's not with anybody. He's sitting down by himself to drink, and he gets drunk. It's hard to say that there wasn't something going on, some type of thought process, some type of goal, some type of, or that something had changed on him, and that the same amount of wine which he had had prior suddenly had a different impact post-flood, something. It's just hard to read this story and not ask, like, really? He just was sitting in his tent on a Friday night, sitting there and got drunk? But that's all the Torah tells us. It tells us nothing else other than he had what to drink and he got drunk. Comments, questions? I'm going to pass this down. Yeah.
Okay, so is it so terrible? I mean, he's not driving.
Isn't that with other people? You know, you say that, like, he can have post-traumatic stress disorder and he got drunk. He's in his tent. If you give him privacy, then he'll come out when he's presentable. So, you know, somebody, one of his sons intruded on his privacy.
Okay, so you're just saying that you don't think it's so bad that in the comforts of his own tent by himself that he should get drunk. Okay. I mean, I think it bears an explanation as to, at least I'd ask you guys a question. Was it just carelessness that he got drunk? Or was it somehow intentional that there was something going on trying to accomplish or something that results in his getting drunk? I'll leave it as a question.
But there's so much significance to everyone's actions after they come out of the flood, because that generation was so debased.
Mm-hmm.
So God and people themselves are clearly watching their actions, because the previous generation, you know, was completely wiped out. They were severely punished.
Okay.
So anything anybody does has got a lot of significance to it and should have a lot of self-examination.
Okay.
So you could say Noah just completely broke down.
Okay, you're giving me an explanation. In other words, I'm asking it as a question. I think you need to ask the question as to what happened that Noah got drunk. So I'll throw three possibilities out. One, it was unintentional. It happened. It just had a few too many drinks. A possibility. Two, it was intentional. There was, be it intentional because of the stress, he just couldn't handle it anymore. Intentional, he was trying to accomplish something else. I don't know what, but you're giving a suggestion as to how it would be intentional. The stress of seeing the world destroyed and now being void and trying to rebuild from nothing, intentionally just needed to get himself drunk. That's a possibility. Maybe there are other possibilities as to what the intention would be. Versus third possibility is somehow the new world order that he was in had changed, and the amount of wine that he had to drink, which would not have gotten him drunk before the flood, now did get him drunk after the flood, and that this is symbolic of a new world order, that the flood has changed something significant in the nature of the world, in the grapes and wine produced, in the nature of the human being who lives in that world, and it was within the world of unintentional. I'm just throwing out possibilities as to, but the main question is, what happened that he got drunk? Yeah.
So the possibility is that when we knock God out of the equation, that we have then we become the power force within our lives.
Well, do you have reason to assume that we knocked God out of the equation?
We don't see him here. He went into his tent, which I see it as a metaphor. He gets lost in his own thoughts, and he begins to dream his dreams. So where is God in all of this, and what is God's... Why is he putting us in this world, and what is our purpose for moving forward?
Okay, so what I would for sure say, what I agree with what you said, is the focus on the fact that he was in his tent. Like what Jennifer said a moment ago, he's in the Torah stresses he was in his tent. So whether or not that was simply in the sense of the privacy, like it wasn't so bad that he got drunk, he did it privately, versus it's some metaphor for something else that he was in his own little world, but the Torah is clearly stressing that where he gets drunk is in his own tent. Fine point.
So the mention of the tent brings to mind the fact that Noah is often compared to Avram Avinu.
Excellent, good point.
The difference. Avram had people to go out to the tent and welcome in and bless it. He had
there is nobody. The world's gone. The world's destroyed.
He couldn't go out and say, come have a drink, have some food with me.
Excellent. Okay, so the word Ohel, right, very much is a reference to the Ohel of Avram, the tent of Avram, and Noah's living in a world devoid of people, by himself in a tent, getting drunk, but it certainly furthers that comparison. Like, you have the image of Avram with his open tent, table full of people, sharing food, sharing thoughts, sharing spirituality, and Noah's in a tent all by himself because the world is destroyed. And that certainly, you know, when you think about the image of Noah getting drunk, that certainly makes it a lot easier to picture, like, what has happened.
But he had his sons.
He has his three sons. That's correct. He has three sons, and eventually he'll have grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and the world become populated. But you could certainly at least hear the mentality of a person looking out at a destroyed world, empty and devoid, and he's alone in his tent, and he gets drunk. Right? So that's certainly an imagery which, you know, that you could hear such a thing. That's a very different world than the world that Avraham lived in 10 generations later. Excellent. Good points. Let's move on. Chof Beis, 22. Vayar Cham Avi Kenan Eis Ervos Aviv. And Cham, the father of Kenan, saw the nakedness of his father. Vayageid L'shnei Yechov Bachutz. And told his two brothers outside.
Not nice.
Not nice. Okay, so who's doing the action here? Cham. And who is Cham? Excellent. He's the middle of the three sons, Shem, Cham, and Yafes. Cham, the middle of the three sons, apparently wanders into his father's tent, sees his father's nakedness, and now the Torah, as Dina just pointed out, tells us that again, and who is Cham? Oh, he's the father of Kenan. What does that have to do with anything in this story? This is the second time in five verses that we're told this piece of information. Cham, who's the one doing the action, he's the one seeing his father, he's the one going outside telling his two brothers, but he's the father of Kenan. Fine, he now sees his father in his state, in his drunken stupor, in his state of nakedness, and he goes and he tells his two brothers, Bachutz, outside. Okay, so far so good?
Well, one question is, what was Cham doing inside the tent that he saw his father?
Good. So clearly he wandered in, or at some point went in, or maybe he heard something, unclear. But this is, right now the Torah has told us that the scene is taking place in Noach's personal tent, and Cham, a son of Noach, now goes and finds him there. So, I don't know, we'll see what the commentaries have what to say. I don't know if it was as simply as innocent as he went in to ask his father a question, and lo and behold what he found, or if he heard something funny and he went snooping around. I don't know. But what we do know is that he ends up in his father's tent and sees his father in his nakedness. Instead of covering his father, instead he goes and he tells his two brothers, Bachutz, tells his two brothers outside what was going on. Many of the commentators, Unkelos amongst them, sees in the word Bachutz outside in a public way. Oh. He didn't like call his two brothers aside privately and say, come, I need your help taking care of dad. Because the Torah specifies and says, where did he tell them? Outside. What's the significance of the Torah telling us that he told his brothers outside? So Targum Unkelos, when he translates the sees, he told them in the shuk. He told them in the marketplace. He told them in a public place so that everybody should know what was going on in his father's tent.
Why didn't he cover him?
Excellent. Right? In other words, so Cham does not step up to the plate and cover his father himself. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Somebody was asking?
Everybody else in the marketplace
should know.
Yes. There was no... There was
right.
A
okay, so yeah. No, so clearly, in other words, no, we don't know. Noah lives for several hundred years after the flood. So we don't know how many years after, in other words, we know that what he does is he starts by planting a vineyard. How long after he plants the vineyard that he harvests the grapes, is it months, years, decade? That the Torah doesn't tell us, but that there seems to be an understanding that the world had begun to become populated again by the time this story happens. Right, he will live another 300 years, that's correct. 350 years he will live after the flood. Okay, 23, Chav Gimel, Vayikach Shem Vayefes Es HaSimla, Shem and Yofes take a garment, Vayasimu Al Shchem Shnehem, and they lay it upon both of their shoulders, Vayilchu Achoyranis, and they walk backwards, Vayachosu Es Ervos Avihem, they covered their father's nakedness, Ufnehem Achoyranis, their faces were backward, Ve'ervos avihem lo ra'u, they saw not their father's nakedness. Comments, questions?
That's what Cham should have done.
That's exactly what Cham should have done, 100%. All right, so Cham, who sees his father first, could have addressed the situation in a way in which no one else would ever know that the situation had happened. Instead, he tells his two brothers, and they take matters into their own hands, taking the garments, and they cover him. Now, the Hebrew readers amongst you will notice in the very first word of this verse, in Chaf Gimel, there's an oddity in the grammar of the Hebrew. Vayikach shem vayofes es hasimla is grammatically incorrect. Vayikach is a singular verb, and he took. So that this translates as, and he, both singular, both shem and cham, took the garment. It should have been vayikchu, they took the garment, and instead the verb that's used is a singular verb, and he took the garment. From which Rashi points out that this initiative was not both of theirs, it was actually Shem's. Vayikach Shem, the first name that's mentioned afterwards, Shem took the garment and got his brother Yofes to join him. Mm-hmm. And that the Torah is hinting that it was not an equal partnership in the idea to cover, meaning there were actually three reactions amongst the three brothers. Chum sees his father's nakedness, does nothing to cover him, and instead goes and rats on him to his two other sons, to Ham's two other brothers. Yefes has a neutral reaction of almost, it seems like, nothingness on his own, but joins with Shem. And Shem has the initiative of, we need to go and cover him. So that Shem takes the initiative, Yefes joins with Shem once he's doing it, and Ham not only doesn't do it when he has a chance, but doesn't even join in when the other two brothers begin that process. So if you want to know like where which other nations came from which son, so just understand the nature of the nation and we'll figure out, you know, which son, you know, where did they come from. But that's what the Torah tells us as far as this. Now there's a stress in walking in backwards. Torah tells us twice that they walked in backwards, which Rashi points out. So not only did they walk in backwards, but even then when they had to maneuver and figure out a way to get the blanket on top of him, they would turn around a second time. So they were constantly being very sensitive to the fact that they should not be exposed to their father's nakedness. And they cover them, they cover their father Noach with the garment that they take with them into his tent. So far so good?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, in the scheme of things, in like world history, world Jewish history, how large of an event, you know, on a scale of 1 to 100, would we say is this action of Shem and Yefes, covering up their father's nakedness?
It speaks to a certain morality that is the fundamental difference.
So, I agree. So, you're answering my question a little bit. In the scheme of things, it's nothing. I mean, like, it means it's not like going into an ark to be saved from a flood. It's not like rescuing Lot from Sodom. It's not. I mean, it was in a single episode, in a single day, that didn't make a major impact in the course of world history as the event itself goes. Noah would have woken up from his drunkenness with or without a blanket on top of him, and then gone on with the rest of his life. So, I mean, in that sense of changing world history, it didn't make that much of an impact. But we will see, it will have major reverberations, major impacts on world history based on Noach's response to his three sons for their various roles in it. So it's interesting to note, which is what I want to point out, that what is not inherently a major event, as we find many events of Sefer Bereishis are inherently major life-altering events. Selling Yosef down to Egypt, throwing him into a pit, his running away, they're like events which are major events which actually impact, you know, world Jewish history. This is a very isolated event which really changed nothing. Nothing at all. Noah is going to wake up, you know, the next day, regardless. Yet, we're going to see from his reaction and the blessings and curses he gives out, the impact that it has. And I think a lot of that has to do with what you're pointing out in terms of the moral code, the behavior, the sensitivity. This is a root, it's a seed, which will have major impacts. And it's just, I just, again, I want to overstress it at this point. It's just interesting where we see these major impactful events out of things which we would not necessarily think inherently are such a major event. And it's actually a theme which we find throughout the Gemara and Tanakh episodes where the sages see in certain behaviors major, major events or streams which wouldn't otherwise, we wouldn't have seen them because they're not inherently big. But in God's eyes, world history is affected by different things than what, you know, the historian's eyes would see. The historian wouldn't see in this anything. Nothing. Yeah.
It reminds me, I don't want to take up too much time, but when our friend Q Beard, before he converted to Judaism, he came to Beth Jacob, and he told me, he observed that when a sefer was turned upside down, people picked it up and turned it in the right way. And that made an enormous impact on him. And from there, other things happened. But it was that simple action of turning a chumash right side up.
Right. Okay, so let's get through. Let's see. Now let's get to what's Noach's response to this. Chaf Dal 24. Noach awoke from his wine and realized what his small son had done unto him.
Who's the small son?
That's an awful lot of
extrapolation. Okay, excellent. Okay, everybody jumping in. Now you guys are waking up a little bit. Now I'm hearing some voices going on. Now we're getting exciting.
I was waiting for you to get to the passage.
Here we go. Okay, yeah. So the Hebrew words are Vayikach, Vayiketz Noach Mieno. He woke up from his wine. Vayedo es asher asolo b'no hakatan. And he knew or realized what had been done to him by his little son. Katan means little. Now, that's a funny way of describing it, because where would we put Ham chronologically?
Middle.
In the middle. He's listed three times, all three times. Shem, Ham, Yofes. And here he's defined as little. All the commentators are going to have what to say exactly. What does the Torah mean? Now, there's a more fundamental problem than that. What did Ham do to Noach?
Nothing.
Right. He did nothing to him. The Torah does not tell us anything. What the Torah tells us was, in verse 22, and Ham saw the nakedness of his father and told his brothers. That does not lend itself to the Noach's reaction of, he realized what Ham had done to him.
Yeah.
Nah, not quite parallel. I mean, you sort of can fit that in, but that's not how we would define the action. It just doesn't fit. If he didn't really do anything to him, he said something about him, maybe. He saw him and told his brothers. So it's interesting that the way that the Torah defines when Noach wakes up, and how did he realize that? All of a sudden, Noach wakes up and he sees, what does he have on him?
Blanket.
A blanket. And the Torah says, and he realized what Ham did to him.
It doesn't make sense.
How did you realize that? Maybe it was Ham who put the blanket on you. Well, what happened between his waking up from his wine, finding himself covered by a blanket, and saying, oh my goodness, that Ham, look what he did to me. We're missing something. So the sages are going to fill this in. What I want to point out is when you read the text, you see where the sages were coming from. Like, what happened in the story? Torah's not telling us enough information. Now, as I mentioned, it has given us enough hints along the way that we'll have to fill it in. But there is clearly part of the story that's missing, that when Noah wakes up, the Torah says, and he realized what Ham did to him. Okay, yeah, someone had a question.
God invaded his space. And
how do you know it's Ham?
How do you know what happened? Alright, so he knows the space has been invaded. Somebody has entered into space or privacy,
mm-hmm.
there alone, and for a certain period of time, he wasn't alone. Something
okay.
transpired where he was not
That's
alone.
100%, and he sees that he's been covered. For all he knows, as far as the text goes, the person who invaded his space was doing it for his benefit to cover him. Because he ends up being covered, right? It's a good thing.
Yeah.
So, if I only have the text, I wouldn't even feel violated, I would feel protected. If you went to sleep drunk and exposed and you woke up covered, is your initial reaction one of loving protection or violation?
Loving protection.
I went to sleep drunk and exposed and I woke up covered. And yet, So all I'm pointing out is that we are clearly missing something in the story, because Noah, instead of waking up feeling lovingly protected, wakes up and says, I realized what Ham had done to me. And look at his next pasuk, Chaf Hei. And he said, cursed is Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers.
That doesn't make sense either.
Let's put our fingers on why does this not make sense. Who's Canaan? Canaan is the son of Ham.
Yeah.
Now the Torah has made its point twice to tell us that Ham is the father of Canaan. But you're Noah. Now we're missing part of the story, but whatever the story that we're missing is, Ham has done something. That's what at least the Torah says, right? He realized what his son Ham had done to him.
It doesn't say Ham. He realized what his
son... Oh, I'm sorry. Correct. Thank you for correcting me. Thank you. In 24, he realized what his little son had done to him. Right? It's the small son. The Torah doesn't say what his son Ham did to him. It said what his small son had done to him. So a lot of ambiguity in that. And then the words out of Noah's mouth are, cursed be Canaan. Who's Canaan? Canaan is the son of Ham, who we have not been told has done anything. But clearly, whatever we're missing in the story is going to have to do with Canaan, because that's Noah's response. Cursed be Canaan. And what is his curse? A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers.
So why is the son being punished?
Good. Right? Why is the son being punished? Excellent. Yeah.
Okay. It doesn't say that Noah was sleeping. It just said he was drunk, but then he woke from the wine, but not from a sleep. He may have been awake when he saw
okay, you're saying the Torah never says he fell asleep. It says he got drunk
and
he became uncovered and he awoke from his wine. I made the assumption that meant that he had been in a drunken stupor, actually asleep. It might just mean he was in a drunken stupor but awake, but clearly in a stupor in which whatever we're missing here, something took place and he was unaware of it and he needed to wake up from that stupor. Okay.
When he said his small son, how are we assuming that it's the son of
Because I think...
Okay, excellent. That's all part. In other words, the Torah only tells us it's the small son, doesn't tell us who, but we know that Noah's response is to curse Canaan, who is his grandson, the son of Ham. Again, I'm raising more questions than I'm answering today, and I'm just raising in terms of, as the flow, where the questions are. Mm-hmm. Now, a servant of servants is an interesting phrase. It would be bad enough just to say you'll be a servant to your brothers, but the language implies you'll be a servant to the servants of your brothers. Your brothers are going to have servants, and you'll be, you know, the servants to them, way down the totem pole as far as them.
That's not how I read it.
Slave.
A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers. I thought that meant his brothers would be servants.
Servants as well.
And he would be a servant to his brothers.
Okay, you can really know that. Maybe the brothers will even be servants, and you'll be a servant to them, who are themselves. It's clearly this double Eved Avadim, a servant of servants, is an interesting language of what the curse will be. Okay, that's fair. Well, let's keep it open to see exactly how we'll interpret that. That's fine. Excellent. 26. And he said, blessed is Hashem, the God of shame, and let Canaan be a slave to them. Right? Fascinating, isn't this? Now, somehow, Noah knows that shame was on the good side of this interaction. We don't know how, because shame and Yefes apparently did everything in their power to be discreet and sensitive when they went in. Maybe this is a proof to what you were suggesting, that he wasn't asleep, he was just in a drunken stupor, but he was somehow able to piece it all together, unclear. But somehow he knows that shame was involved, and that shame was the initiator of the idea to take the garment. Mm-hmm. But does he bless shame?
Blesses
God, who is the God of shame. It's an interesting blessing. Blessed is Hashem. Vayomer, I'm reading the Hebrew. Baruch Hashem Elokei Shem. Blessed is Hashem, the God of shame, and let Canaan, again, Canaan, like who didn't do anything, Canaan is the grandson of the son of Ham, let Canaan be a servant to them, the descendants of shame. 27. May God yoft Elokim liyefes. Right, poetic, Yefes is the name, and the blessing is a poetic takeoff of that name, Yaft, which means, the commentators explain Rashi and Unkelus, to expand or extend. May God extend Yefes. Unclear exactly what that means, to be extended or expanded. And he shall dwell in the tents of shame. And also, then he concludes, and let Canaan be a servant to them. Very difficult. What is this place? Now, Vayishkon bo'ohel shame is actually interesting also, whether or not, and he shall dwell in the tents of shame, if that is a capital H or a lowercase h. Now, in the English, you have to choose one, and I did. But in the Hebrew, I can read that verse both ways. I can read it as, may God extend Yefes. But he, capital H, even though he extends the tents of Yefes, but he, capital H, himself, will dwell in the tents of shame. So that the blessing is, God will take care of you, Yefes. He will extend your boundaries. But he himself will dwell amongst shame. Or it can be read as a lowercase h, God will extend you, Yefes, and you will dwell amongst the tents of shame. So that even in your expanded blessing, but your expanded blessing will be in the overarching tents of shame. You hear the two ways that that could be read? Now, I have to choose one, and I chose the lowercase h, which is what ArtScroll does, but we will see that there are two ways. In the Hebrew, it could be read either way. Yaft Elokim Liefes, there are two pronouns in that first phrase. Yaft Elokim, God should expand you, Yefes. Vayishkon, and he shall dwell in the tents of shame. Which pronoun is the he modifying? That God, even after he expands you, but he will then expand you and ignore you, and he will dwell in shame, or he will expand you, and even in your expanded stand, you will be in the tents of shame. And Canaan shall be a servant to you as well. So that's the three responses that Noah has to this episode. So this episode, which again a historian would have totally overlooked, but Noah doesn't. And Noah comes down hard on Canaan, who is the son of Ham.
Why is that?
Good question. Not for today. I have 1 minute left. Comes down hard on Canaan, Delpi, as a Eved Avadim, a servant of servants, a slave of slaves. Gives these blessings to Shem, who initiated this project, that he says, blessed is Hashem, the God of Shem. Then to Yefes says, you should be expanded. Yaft Elokim Liefes, you should be expanded. And then this ambiguous phrase, which we're not sure what to do with. And then either that God should dwell in the tents of Shem, which would be part of Shem's blessings, that he should house God's presence, or that Shem will be the overarching brother, that even Yefes with his blessing will still be consumed under Shem. Either way, exactly how we'll interpret that. And then the curse to Canaan is repeated both times. Canaan, you should be a servant to Yefes. Canaan, you should be a servant to Shem. Let me just read the last two verses so we can conclude our first run-through. And Noach lived after the flood 350 years, and all the days of Noach were 950 years, and he died. That's it for Noach. So that this episode, which is the only episode we're told following the flood, Noach lives for 350 years post the flood. What are we told about those 350 years? This. Planted a vineyard, gets drunk, something happens to him, and then he gives these blessings and curses. And that's all the time. We have no need for Noach after this. Leaves 350 years and he dies. I hope I've at least justified why I didn't do the binding of Isaac and felt it necessary that there were some important stories which are really not well understood before the binding of Isaac that we need to do. Okay, so this is round one. Ritz Hashem, we will continue. We'll start putting some pieces together, going through some of the Mefarshim, the commentators, the Midrashim, and seeing what we get out of this fascinating little episode.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.